Would you introduce yourselves, please?
Hi, I'm Charlie.
And I'm Tom, and we're from There in the Well.
The second I put this on, it was not hard to tell what you were trying to do here. You were making a movie, only it just happens to be on a little round five-inch thing. And the second I heard the music and heard the lyrics and heard the songs, but really, how does it feel to actually have an album that is actually full of songs? Real live narrative songs that actually becomes a hit in this day and age, because that's kind of unheard of. You actually don't repeat the chorus more than, you know, twice. You actually have real live, and I'm not being facetious.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, thank you very much. That it feels good, certainly. I mean, definitely with this record, what we were trying to do was combine like direct styles of pop songs, you know, with narrative storytelling, you know, like you say. I guess the fact that people like it hopefully means to some extent we've achieved that, you know, which feels good.
It rarely does happen in the modern music world that bands, you know, doing the thing that we're doing actually have like a credibility in today's world.
So again, I have the pleasure of going to film festivals. So one Noah Baumbach, one Wes Anderson are people that I've had the pleasure of watching what they do. Now, I know you're fans of them. I'm curious what you've heard from them. Are they fans of the band?
We were talking about this earlier today, actually. I've no idea. I mean, the only thing I've heard was on one of our social networking websites, I think it was like on MySpace or something, I don't know, this girl had messaged us saying she's a waitress in this New York restaurant that Noah Baumbach frequently frequents. She slipped him a bunch of our CDs, apparently. And I don't know what he thought of them, but some girl gave them to him. Did actually, yeah. Well, no, it was weird. I was in, we made like a short film to go with the previous album, and I was in this sort of editing room, and I was getting out a lift, and Wes Anderson was getting in the lift, but I didn't say anything.
You've taken this whole cinematic gesture even to your website. Today, I took a break at lunch and I visited the cinema. So, and that is, unless I'm terribly mistaken, that is a real cinema in London that I think I've been to. Am I correct?
Well, as far as I know, it was based on the Phoenix Cinema in Finchley, but I think it was doctored slightly. For rock and roll purposes. It was a cool thing we did there, hopefully, that, you know, it was a cinema set up online so people could come and watch a little documentary about making the album. And I guess, you know, to get people kind of into your records these days, you probably need to be a bit more inventive.
Night Windows versus, I mean, it started as Old Joy for about a second there, and you dumped that, made that the last track on the album. Like, we cannot name this great cinematic portrayal of a night, you know, Old Joy, because people are going to be like, what's that? That's not going to work. Now, Night Windows could have been some sort of little, you know, triumvirate film with different, you know, different scenes. But take me through the process, because you obviously, when you got to Last Night on Earth, where did that come in the process with the songs?
Well, no, we came up with a title. That was the last thing we had, the title, which is strange, actually. The previous album, before anything, we had the name of the album before we had any songs, really. But it was, yeah, we were kind of just finished mastering it, and it was between, it'd come down to Last Night on Earth versus Night Windows after the Hopper painting. And I guess what I liked about Night Windows is how the album is looking into people's lives for one evening, you know, looking through their window at night. But then... Exactly, in a very voyeuristic way. But in the same way, what I like about Last Night on Earth, I guess, is that it has the double meaning that it can be that, like it can be last night as it happened on Earth, people's lives, or there's like an urgency to it being last night on Earth, you know.
From what I read, 9 months recording demos. So you spent this was, you know, aside from how long it took to get, you know, forgetting that, you know, everybody assumes that bands have to put out records. You know, Woody Allen puts out a film a year, but bands don't have to put out a record a year. Rarely does that work. If it does, they're really, really absurdly lucky.
The demoing was done at this sort of converted synagogue in Bethnal Green, which is now just like a big room, you know, with a high ceiling. And there was a real vibe to the demos, you know, so a lot of that stuff that we recorded there is still on the record. Like, there's drum takes and vocal takes that we kept from that. But then the bulk of it was done in Los Angeles. there was one studio where we did most of it in Venice that is rumored to have been Bob Dylan's in the 70s. And then you got Sunset Sound, Sound City. And then we did a bit of recording in my flat, and I called it Hangman Palace Studios. So that's credit on the album as Hangman Palace Studios, which is actually just like my bedroom.
As you can probably figure out, I'm a sound guy. And, you know, I listen to things on good stuff. And even scarily enough in my Prius, there's pretty darn good JBL speakers. And the bass, the warmth, the warmth of this record, what you did is, I'm going to get geeky for a second here. What you did is kind of interesting in that you pumped up the bass as you would in a dance record. And that's very, very obvious because it resonates. But in the old days, you know, top 40 singles, they cranked up the bass. You did that intentionally on this entire record, did you not?
We did, and especially if you look at the previous records where the bass pretty much doesn't feature at all. Yeah. Again, it's something that, you know, we want to do differently. But it just, it, as you say, it makes sense sonically with having it at the forefront.
I wanted this record to be able to compete sonically with any record out at the moment, you know what I mean? And I mean, people make records loud at the moment, like too loud, like so compressed that it's like unlistenable, a lot of it. But I wanted to make a record that could be loud, you know what I mean? But then I didn't want to lose any of the sort of warmth or intricacy that we've had on previous records, you know. And I think that's part of, yeah, like as you say, the synths we used were mostly, well, most exclusively analog synths, like Prophet 5s and whatever, and then Tom's strings, you know, that helps blend it and make it feel like it's like a real band, you know.
So again, we're not going to do influences, but I'll say the word Street Hassle. But one of the things that I read is, you know, there's obviously a little, our local friend who lives actually just up north about 40 miles, Tom Waits, lives, you know, 40 miles north of where we're sitting right now. But these are two men that do what you've taken it, you've filtered it through what you do, right? Because your songs, they don't, you know, maybe it sounds a little bit like Walk on the Wild Side or whatever it is, but that's 10 minutes. This is a 33-minute record, so tell me how you manage to slap all of that narrative stuff in short pop songs. What's your editing process? What do you do? Because it's pretty phenomenal when you think about all the lyrics and all the stuff that's in there in these little 3-minute epics.
You know, honestly, I don't know how much it's balanced, because part of it is just, that's how it is, you know. I listen to a bunch of Lou Reed and I listen to a bunch of Tom Waits, and then I try and write my own songs, and, you know, it has influence and it filters through.
But you definitely have some sort of very, very strong filtering process that somehow gets it to be a Noah and the Whale song versus a, I like these artists, I'm going to emulate them. There's something different about it.
I think there's something about the way we play together as well, you know. But I think what happened with this record, and it's the same with each record, is for us it's like you find the mood, you find the heart of the record first, you know what I mean? And so that's when the influences come in, and also whatever writers you're reading at the time, you know, and you get a feel for almost what the record looks like, you know what I mean? And then you start to flesh out arrangements together and things like that. And I guess, I mean, that's the thing people have asked me before, like, what's the sort of binding thing that keeps our sound together? But I don't really know. I guess it's just us, how we work together, really.
It's interesting how you say, you know, how do we manage to filter it into how it sounds, you know, filter those influences. Because the record, that demoing period, we had the songs down pretty quick, the rough, you know, the actual structures and whatever. And it was a matter of, over those 9 months, filtering and making the songs concise. They did, some of them started off like 9-minute tracks. But that, I think that's where we've managed to find a skill in making things concise.
It's funny because one of the movies you haven't mentioned that, have you seen After Hours? Okay, so the next movie, your assignment. This album relates to a movie by Scorsese called After Hours, and it's Rosanna Arquette, and she gets into a taxi, and she gets lost in downtown Greenwich Village, and all these things happen to her. And tonight's the kind of night, if that song was out when that movie came out, it would have been the opening song. what is the what's the couple of minute narrative of what happens to this human being?
Wow. I mean, there's a few stories on there, but I think the most sort of binding thing is people making changes, you know. And there's a few films influenced. I mean, I guess there's two parts to it. I think there's the sort of the romantic nighttime Bukowski and New York kind of vibe that you're talking about, which is definitely there. And then there's also, to some extent, I feel like there's a small element in a few songs of like this sort of coming of age thing, you know, which was influenced by this song, film Breaking Away. But yeah, no, I think the most important thing to take from it is people making changes, you know, or on the precipice of it.
Well, and I just can't imagine how this segue won't work. Changes. Let's see. How many drummers did I read? You auditioned 100 friggin' drummers to come up with a 21-year-old drummer? This is either going to freak you out or not, but the way that I got to know you, I mean, I knew the first album, but for interestingly enough, in Austin, Texas, when one Laura Marling was making, had just on the day she had released her first record, you did the record. You did the Laura, you know, you did the breakup record. You did that. But the Everything Has Changed is a happy record, which goes to show you, I suppose, that the moral of the story is make your sad, desolate, sad record, awful, terrible, go through it publicly, and then make the happy record and have a huge hit.
Well, you know.
Is that what everybody should do?
I don't know. Everyone has their own journey, don't they? But I think it was like, it was about so many things, this record, what sort of launched it. And when we started this record, we just, when First Days of Spring came out, the second record, we kind of did a 3-month tour in which, yeah, we lost drummers, we lost band members, we lost, our gear got stolen, you know. And then we came back and this first song was written on New Year's Day, you know, the next year. And it was like, it was just, you know, the band needed a sort of a change, a new life. And it was just one of those things that, it just felt good writing these songs and playing this music. You know, it made sense.
I don't see this band. I've had them all on. Okay, I've had Magic Numbers on. I've had Mumford & Sons on. I don't see this band as a folk band. I don't see it in the category. So I just want to break this really fast. This is your opportunity to destroy the whole genre thing, because last I knew, this wasn't a folk record. This is a big record. This is not a folk record.
100%.
So let's destroy that,
okay,
shall we?
100%. Nur and the Whale are not a folk band. You heard it here. The thing is, I've never really considered us a folk band. I mean, we've got a violinist in the band, so that's why people assume folk music, you know. But now we're just a straight up rock and roll band.
The Water Sisters, these vocals in the backup. Oh my God, tell me about that. Oh my God, as they say.
Well, you mind, they're like legendary, the Water Sisters, you know, like Michael Jackson and yes. Neil Diamond, whatever. I mean, it was, we sat around this piano playing Old Joy for the first time with them singing it. That was a moment, definitely.
Thing is they're the kind of professional that just makes recording any track just exquisite, you know? Yeah. They walk in the studio, okay, they need like a cup of coffee with 6 sugar cubes in it, but that's all they need. And then they go in there and boom, you've got like the most beautiful harmonies ever.
But so much has been made about the look of the band, the look of the band. So can we also kind of just, you know, say that it's not a matter of being a fashion plate. You just felt like you wanted to look like a classic, like the bands that you probably respect that actually used to dress a little bit. You know, because T-shirts get old.
You're absolutely right, you know. And also, you've got to remember that we formed this band. I mean, Tom was, I guess, 18, 19 when we started the band, and I was 20. And, you know, I guess we also want to, like, grow up a little bit, you know. We're becoming men now, you know. Exactly. You know, it wasn't like we didn't sit down tactically around a table pushing, you know, things around a map, being like, okay, so we're going to wear this jacket with that tie, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You've been, okay, here's what the plan is for the band. Well, okay, you'll wear the green and you'll wear the blue and then we'll conquer the world.
Now, I guess probably now more than ever is like how you visually represent the band connects people to the songs. You know, it's really important. You know, and I think, because often, like now, and I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, I guess it's a bad thing, but a lot of the time, first place people go is YouTube to check out a band. Do you know what I mean? And what you can't avoid now is every show you do is documented, you know? To some small extent, someone will always have a camera, always have a phone, you know, exactly.
So I've come up with a thing called a musical sandwich, and we've done this with over 300 bands. and it's two of your songs as the bread, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.